Live from New York, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to take a look at music is more effective than drugs at releasing the brain's natural painkillers. We're also going to look at how wild oregano oil provides relief for all forms of diseases, how not drinking enough water has the same effect as drunk driving, how vitamins that reduce your risk of skin cancer are easy and inexpensive, but we're not using them, and a lot more. Then we're going to do our conversations with remarkable minds, but we have two sets of conversations. The first, in about 15 minutes, will be with Professor Jim Garrison. He is the founding president of Ubiquity University and the Wisdom School of Graduate Studies, an international school of higher education built upon innovative principles of whole brain and whole system learning. The university operates on four continents, and he was the former co-founder and president of the Gorbachev Foundation. And he was instrumental in the founding of the State of the World Forum. And he also was one of the executive directors of the Esalen Institute. And so he has a lot of background. He also has graduate degrees in religion and theology from Harvard University and Cambridge University. And his website, wisdomuniversity.org and ubiquityuniversity.org. We're going to talk about the demise of higher education and what is being demanded to start a new renaissance in teaching students. That will be followed by a conversation between two of our seminal thinkers in the United States, Chris Hedges on the one side, with Dr. Cornel West on the other, upon the nature of our thinking about race and what we can do and should know, a different conversation. That's 25 minutes. So we have a heady program today, so let's begin. Music can heal. It can help the process of healing. According to 400 different scientific papers, music has been proven that music is medicine. Neurochemical benefits of music can improve your immune system, reduce anxiety levels, help regulate mood in ways that drugs cannot. Quote, we found compelling evidence that musical interventions can play a health role in settings ranging from operating rooms to family clinics. But even more importantly, we are able to document the neurochemical mechanisms by which music has an effect on the four domains: management of mood, stress, immunity, and an aid in social bonding. End quote. That was Professor Levitin of McGill University Psychology Department. The review appearing in the peer review Trends in Cognitive Science was prompted by the growing number of studies addressing evidence-based music interventions as opposed to music therapy, which is something else. And prior to this review, no one had really taken the time to look at what all the new evidence was suggesting. Indeed, music is frequently used for self-medicating purposes. Many of us listen to music as a way to calm ourselves or give us a boost. And we do it as frequently, if not so, with as much intent as possible. For example, on yesterday's program, I played you some gospel music by Mr. Bailey. And many have done this song, but I just love the energy. It's the energy. It just gets you up. Well, and there are other sounds, the flute, especially flute from the Peruvian village masters who go into the rainforest and play their flutes by waterfalls and capture that. We love to hear that. So different types of music for different occasions. And anytime someone comes to me who is highly stressed or who has cognitive functional issues, I always suggest de-stressing, music, turn off the cell phones, get off the computers, just be present and mindful, because it plays a role. And indeed, 400 studies show that. So if you feel stressed, if you feel that you need to take a break from the hecticness of life and its demands, remember, when you play soft music and soothing music, you are flooding the brain and the body with natural opiates. And this raises your pain threshold, in some cases, so much that you can actually get off morphine-like painkillers. In one of those unusual circumstances in life, one of America's most orthodox oncologists, meaning at the high end of the pecking order, the medical school she works for, the colleagues she has associations with, the nature of the practice, 100% chemotherapy, even when her patients are dying, honor the protocol, even when the protocol is a part of killing the patient. But this person actually took the time, to her credit, she did, to see what are their approaches. And I so told her, I said, I never treat or diagnose any illness. I never look at cancer or heart disease or diabetes. I never have a discussion on these issues with a person, because that's not what's important. The primary problem is changing the foundation upon which a person lives, the quality of their beliefs and values. Is it honoring them? The nature of their intrinsic life energies. Are they honoring those life energies, or did they grow up mastering someone else's life energy? Meaning, if your parents were adaptive supporters and the worker bees of society that are essential to all things, did they encourage you to do the same, and did you? But inside of you was something saying, you look at things differently, you see things differently, you hear conversations differently, you respond to people differently, but you hid that because maybe you're a creative assertive, you're an artist, but we're never encouraged to do that. I happen to know that for a reason, because my best friend growing up, from age one, we grew up together, was Tom Croft. Tom was an All-American football player. He was one of the best good old boys you'd ever meet. Always funny and calm and positive. Big guy, 6'4 to 6'5, outstanding quarterback. And one day, and we were in high school, at the end of high school, he said, I want to show you something, Gary. And I didn't know what it was. And he opened his closet, pushed back some clothes, took out a box, and started showing me all this poetry he'd written. And he says, you tell anyone, I'm going to kill you. He said, you can't tell anyone I write poetry, because if you do, they'll think I'm strange. I said, Tom, this is really good poetry. Why are you hiding it? He said, well, you know, in our hometown, if you're a jock, you're a jock. You know, you got to live the jock life. I don't want anyone to think there's something different, because here we got to live together for the rest of our lives in this community. And you know how people are when someone's different on any level. Gossip about them, exclude them. I don't want that. So I just keep it quiet. He had written over 500 poems. So I suggested that he take those poems and he submit them to poetry magazines. 2 years later, after high school, when he was in college down at Clemson, he did. And he got them published. He then went on to become a writer. And he also loved coaching, so he coached. But he worked for newspapers, he wrote articles, and he was always happy the fact that he came forward and honored his real-life energy. And it changed his disposition in life. How many times have we lived someone else's life and always knowing that no matter how well we did it, conscious, obedient, thoughtful, with quality, there was still some sense of emptiness, incompleteness. Frequently, that's not honoring our own life energy. So when you see someone, even this doctor, and I said, you know, the work you're doing on cancer, using chemotherapy to death. I said, have you ever seen an advanced cancer patient anywhere in your world where collectively you've treated hundreds of thousands of patients, you and the other doctors, that have reversed? She says, no. That's why I want to see because you have so many of these people who should be dead. In fact, she brought me a person that she said she didn't believe would withstand the trip. She would die. She only had days to live anyhow. So she had been given so much chemotherapy, so much radiation. There was nothing left, cancer in every organ in the body. And I said, so why are you doing this? Are you going to change? If you see an improvement in this person, will you go back and implement those? No. And that's the irony in our society. Even when a different truth, a different reality is shown and proven to someone, it does not mean they're going to change. That's how powerful our conditioning is. But in any case, the person was in excruciating pain. Mind you, pain, cancer, the lungs, the liver, the pancreas, the bone, the brain, the breast, and the abdomen. Everywhere, cancer. And put on soft music. What's your favorite music? Very soft music. Harp, flute, violin. And suddenly, 20 minutes later, how are you feeling? It's strange. I don't have that pain right now. Opiates. The opiates that manifest. Now, could you imagine if in every hospital in America they played a music that a person knew relaxed them, they could select their music? It's so easy to do. There are 100,000 songs you could put up and select from, and you could give people headsets so they can listen to them, not bother other people. So the latest study shows that you create natural pain relief for any form of pain. Also, here's what else they found. You can feel like you're rewarding yourself. It motivates you. There's a pleasure principle. For example, music helps with eating disorders. Stress and arousal, it helps reduce anxiety. Immunity, it strengthens the body's immune system and slows down the age-related decline. And social affiliation, it assists in trust building and social bonding. So our takeaway message today is this. When you select the music that is most calming, what you're doing is you're engaging four primary neurochemical systems. Dopamine and opiates, cortisol, reducing your stress-related hormones, serotonin, your feel-good hormones, and creating oxytocin, your love hormone. And hence, why we love certain music, and we call them, what do we call them? Love songs. Love songs remind us. Immediately our brain goes back to those moments, those times, those gestures, possibly long ago, and it reconnects us instantaneously. Quote, we know music facilitates active neurochemical processes in a symphony of opiates, which pharmaceutical intervention has been unable to match. End quote, Dr. Francis Chandra, one of the senior authors. So something that can make a difference in our lives. Now, wild oregano oil is one of the oils you should always keep handy because food poisoning, it works along with charcoal capsules and aloe vera for anything you may have eaten and that may have been contaminated. Wild oregano oil. Viruses and bacteria. Wild oregano oil. Well, today, according to Green Med Info and Sayer G down there, doing good work as always, we are faced with an enormous emerging series of diseases, and sometimes your doctor just doesn't know what to do. And what do? The knee-jerk antibiotic, even if it's viral, which antibiotics don't work on. And, for example, they have what is called the winter vomiting disease, and it's been seen globally. How about the digestive disorders that are on the rise? And how about all the yeast and bacteria proliferating unchecked and creating havoc with the inner world of our stomach and intestine? No one knows what to do with those in the orthodox model. But we also know that wild oregano oil can provide relief from parasites or even GMO foods. Some practitioners are using the benefits of wild oregano oil for relief of all these assaults. It's been shown to destroy unwanted bacteria, kill off fungus, and yeast parasites and other viruses. It's been shown to relieve symptoms of winter vomiting disease, another newly labeled disorder appearing to impact a lot. And the wild oregano oil plant is related to the mint family. And when the flowers and leaves are harvested, the oil content is at its highest. And wild oregano oil, hence, is an alternative that many holistic doctors reach for to relieve symptoms. And there are many kinds of oils, and they're all good, and there are many wild Mediterranean oils, and they're exceptionally good. And the wild Mediterranean oregano comes in two varieties, the thymus, which is good, and the organium, O-R-I-G-A-N-U-M. They're both good for health. And why? What is it? What's the mystery? Well, it's not a mystery. It is called Carvacrol, C-A-R-V, Carv-A-Crol, C-R-O-L. It's an extraordinarily powerful antimicrobial. Carvacrol has been shown to be effective against Candida albicans and Aspergillus mold, Staphylococcus, Campylobacter, thought to be responsible for some ulcers, E. coli, Giardia, Pseudomonas, Salmonella, and Listeria. So terpenes are yet another category of phytochemical within the oil of oregano, as well as thymol, T-H-Y-M-O-L. And that's a natural fungicide with antiseptic properties. And that's why if I see, for example, in the middle of summer and I'm growing some vegetables and maybe some mold happens if it's particularly wet, I will take a bottle and I will dilute wild oregano oil and garlic oil in equal measure, 30 to 1, 30 parts water to 1 part wild oregano oil. I'll put it in just a simple hand sprayer, a mister, and I would just mist that over the plants in the ground. And lo and behold, 2 days later, mold's dead, plants protected. It's also a natural insecticide. In fact, the Carvacrol is a natural insect repellent. So when I was in the Amazon rainforest, I simply sprayed myself. And one of the things that was in that was wild oregano oil, diluted. And, yeah, it tastes bad, has a little caustic burning sensation. But if you dilute it properly with a carrier oil, let's say olive oil or water, and then it you never want to put undiluted oil on your skin or the mucous membranes or the organs. So that's our latest, something really important. And finally, not drinking enough water has the same effect as drunk driving. That's correct. According to the Telegraph, on a study that was just published and appeared in the Journal of Physiology and Behavior, quote, having as few as 5 sips of water an hour while driving is equivalent to being over the drunk driving limit. Drivers make more than twice as many mistakes when they are just mildly dehydrated. The new study revealed that drivers who had a relatively small amount of water per hour made more mistakes than those who had more water and did not. This was done by a professor, Ron Mon, emeritus professor of sports and exercise nutrition, who led the study at Loughborough University. Quote, we all deplore drunk driving, but we don't usually think about the effects of other things that affect our driving skills, and one of those is not drinking and dehydration. There is no question that driving, while incapable through drinking, drugs, increases the risk of accidents, but our finding highlight an unrecognized danger and suggest that drivers should be encouraged to make sure they are properly hydrated, end quote. Good for them. Back in a moment with my guest. Please stay with us. to welcome all of you and to the family of the woman who came, a medical family, husband, Orthodox physician, almost all the family are, and the woman is in end stage multiple sclerosis, generally a very short time after they hit end stage. You're listening now from South Africa. This morning, your mother, without the aid of the person who came with her, her cousin, was able on her own to, using the walker, to walk up the steps, her knees bent, her leg flexed forward, and with energy. I thought you'd like to know she's making great progress with what all of medicine said was not possible. And guess who was beside her to encourage her? Kenny, the plumber from New Jersey, who 6 years ago had an irreversible multiple sclerosis, couldn't even walk up the steps to the office to the work study being done on the subject. And 3 years ago, his two sets of neurologists who had been preparing him for the final stages of his life with the railings around his house and then the railings on his bed said that they could find no multiple sclerosis, no demyelinization. They didn't know what happened. They didn't ask him what happened, but they said he no longer had multiple sclerosis. But today he's completely, vitally healthy. And he came here to encourage the woman as an example. And all it takes is an example. Remember, no one in the world believed that a human body could break a 4-minute mile running until a man named Bannister did it, and very shortly thereafter, many people did it. What were they waiting for? I believe that all it takes is one to open a door to a new realm of consciousness. That said, in our conversation with Remarkable Minds, we have Dr. Jim Garrison. I gave you his bio earlier in the program. Let's say hello to him now. He's out in Mill Valley, California. Nice to have you with us today, Jim.
Hi, Gary. Good morning.
I want to begin with an article published in Forbes magazine last month, which started by stating that, quote, higher education is failing to meet the needs of both students and employers, and only a fundamental transformation can put it on the right track, end quote. Now, basically, Jim, the essay made the case that industry leaders are reaching an agreement that higher education, as it is designed and taught today, can no longer prepare graduates for the future work of the world. However, this next piece is what I found interesting and where the real hypocrisy comes in. While these are industry leaders stating this, American education today, with some exceptions, has become increasingly more corporate. Universities function like corporations, and much of their assets are given by corporations. And I know for certain in the medical profession and private pharmaceutical funds given to medical schools accompany conditions on what can be taught or researched as long as it is in keeping with Big Pharma's agenda. Now, dissension from that agenda is not permitted, and students' critical thinking about medical practice suffers. And next, the industry leaders limit this transformation to three major efforts. Two seem feasible, using technology to improve actual experience, and then to provide more practical and applicable educational experiences for students. But the third one is to strengthen university relationships with private strategic partners. And doesn't this simply put universities further into the jaws of a capitalist paradigm, which has already been part of the demise of higher education today? And then one other point that the Forbes article supports is greater uniformity across course offerings and requirements. And this raised the question, at least for me, about whether a uniform model of education will deter students' vision and creativity and further force it into the mindset that is already creating havoc around the planet. Your thoughts, the forum is yours.
Well, first of all, thank you, Gary, for opening up the discussion on education in that way. I think it's very much the case, as the Forbes article indicated, that education across the board is in a crisis. And I think there's probably few, if any, sectors of our political economy that are as archaic and obsolete as our educational model. And over the last, I would say, 30 years, really since the Reagan administration, and the determination on the part of the political elites to begin national defunding of education, that has forced not only massive increases in tuition. For example, when I was in school, I'm from the 60s, and when I started school in the late 60s, it cost $250 a year to go to UC Berkeley. And today, it costs around $45,000. And that escalation of student prices because of the downgrading of public support for education through the tax dollar has led both to massive student debt and also the corporatization of our educational institutions, because at the heart of our educational institutions, particularly in terms of higher learning at the college, university level, research and development is a critical part of what academia means in society. It is our schools that both train the young and provide institutional infrastructure and support for the kind of cutting-edge research, not only in terms of science and technology, but research into, you know, archaeology and geography and climate, et cetera, et cetera. And as that support from the federal and state levels have been systematically and by policy formation reduced and reduced and reduced, the corporations have filled the vacuum. And as you indicated in your opening remarks, that's led to a situation in which the corporate agenda is now more and more becoming the academic agenda. So you have two massive problems. One is the crisis of student debt, and Wall Street, true to form, is treating student debt, which is now higher than credit card debt and any other debt, with the exception of the housing debt, as they did in 2007, 2008 in the subprime mortgage debacle. They're now beginning to bundle student debt and selling them just like they did with the real estate. And there's about $1.2 trillion in debt. And one of the reasons why the corporations then filling that vacuum are allowed to do so unimpeded is because both the institutions have no choice. The students are more and more being turned into indentured servants. And so you have a really the breaking of the American promise. It used to be when I was a young man, that if you went to college, you were basically guaranteed a job. And that was the promise of higher education. Now, 50% of all the students who graduate either are unemployed or underemployed at the minimum wage level. They have massive debt. The average student debt now is $30,000-$35,000 and climbing on the average. And if that's just for a BA degree, for anybody going for, say, a law degree or a medical degree, you're talking about debt by the time they're in their mid to late 20s of $200,000-$400,000, which means they come out, they have no recourse but to work in the kind of the corporate machine. And so education has been ground down and is now being rebuilt in the corporate image. And so the crisis in education and the need to completely reimagine and restructure education is certainly something that I and my colleagues have been doing as we've designed Ubiquity University, which we're bringing actually into the market next month in September, with a completely new design, which we believe will go a long way to remedy some of these critical issues.
I appreciate that insight. Thank you, Jim. One of the big issues that divides the left and many progressives still is whether we continue to try to erode the current dominant system and in parallel develop a new system to ultimately replace it, or do we work at reforming the present paradigm from within? And I would imagine from your personal experience with the State of the World Forum and trying to reform the system with multi-stakeholder initiatives is futile. I know I don't try to reform anything. I try to transform. And the influence of power and wealth is just too overwhelming to achieve anything more than small concessionary changes on the surface while leaving the underlying infrastructure of inequality and destruction unscathed. And isn't it the truth of education today? Obama speaks of the rhetoric of educational inequality and high costs, but then he and the government see that billions of dollars are coming in from students that you just mentioned, the perpetual debt. You mentioned $1.2 trillion, the second highest type of debt in the population outside of homeowners, behind credit card or ahead of credit cards.
That's
so
right.
How in the world would one reform that? So speak about the alternative and how you came to a concept that better than reform what was not reformable was to start from scratch and do a new paradigm.
Yeah, it's worth just noting that the U.S. government makes more profit off of student debt than Apple makes off of its computers and ExxonMobil makes off of oil. The educational sector is more heavily subsidized by the government through student debt than by several orders of magnitude than the fossil fuel industry, for example. And the insidious nature of it is that, just to take a moment on that, then I'll get to the issue of reform, is the government gives the universities the money, and then the student pays back the principal and the interest. So like the fossil fuel industry, there's no incentive for lowering your costs, and that's why, you know, the cost of living index has gone up, I think, 150-200% in the last 20-25 years, and the cost of education has escalated 1,200-1,300% because they can raise their costs as much as they want, and it's the students, you know, the late teenage, early 20s, millennials that are paying the debilitating price back to the government that is now making such massive profits off of the student debt. They're locked in the same corporate machine that Obama occasionally gives speeches decrying. So in the face of this, I think you're right. I mean, you know, Buckminster Fuller said many years ago that the best way to transact true change is not to reform the old, but to create the new. And so that's what we've been doing through Ubiquity University in three fundamental ways. Number one, designing the content of the actual studies in a way that emphasizes new ideas, new information, new paradigms. I mean, you've spoken volumes on this program about the lock that the big pharmaceutical companies have on our medical schools, and the whole scientific technical paradigm. You can't get a job in the Western educational system of higher education unless you buy in to that paradigm. And if you're a heretic, you don't last very long. Why? Because you have to either publish or perish as an academic. And if you don't toe the sort of the orthodox line, you don't get published because all the major publications are all in the scientific material paradigm. They're all supporting, you know, better living through chemistry. And that is where the research money goes because it's controlled by the corporate and the military industrial sectors. So it's a self-contained system. So if you're going to deal with that, in a political reality which can only be called totalitarian, the mechanisms of normal democracy are no longer able to transact any meaningful change. But one of the extraordinary things is, because it's a big world out there, and national boundaries tend to stop at borders, and different state jurisdictions are all competing, there's actually, in the midst of all this, an extraordinary opportunity to recreate a new system. So we have done that by attracting faculty. Someone like yourself, for example, would be very welcome to teach at Ubiquity University, because we want, when the students come in from their very first class, to be confronted with new information and new perspectives. You know, they say revolution is the domain of the young. And because, and that's why, you know, you look back to the French Revolution and many of the revolutions that have swept the world, even the American Revolution, it was the young people. People don't remember that Thomas Jefferson and that whole group of people were very young men in their 20s and in their early 30s at the time of the revolution. So we believe that if you give the young people new information in a compelling way, with authority figures that can speak to the emergence of a new worldview, that is an incredibly important piece. And then number two, to navigate the world that is coming, which is fraught with hyper-complexity and fraught with dynamic change, climate change and everything else, you need more than just analytical intelligence and mathematical intelligence and scientific empirical capacities. You need to be emotionally intelligent. You need to be socially, artistically, spiritually intelligent. So we've designed an academic system, Gary, an integral operating system, really, where all the different intelligences that comprise the human being are activated, not just the left brain. And when you do that, it's amazing how you begin to activate the highest potential of the students, particularly when it's accompanied with new thinking and new ideas, because that's what the young are looking for, is the new ideas and how they maximize their potential, and because they're moving into their adulthood. And part of this is educating them that just because they have a degree doesn't mean they're going to get a job. They have to be entrepreneurial. They have to be innovative. So we've designed a very interesting system to develop that. And then thirdly and finally, it has to be affordable. So we've designed a learning program where you can get a BA degree for only $12,000. That means if you go full-time, it will cost about $3,000 a year. And the way we did it is we pegged what it would cost a student working a part-time job. And most kids out there, most young people, could get a part-time job and bring in $3,000 a year so that they could get a good education, a world-class education, for a minimal amount of money. And what we've done in the Global South, because we're launching globally, where even $3,000 is a challenge, we've opened it up to say that students can collectively take a course. So, for example, if the tuition is $300 a course, two or three of them can come together. Each one of them pays $100 because they're in Ethiopia or Togo or Sri Lanka. And then we allow a collective learning experience to happen at the other end of an online capacity. So this combination of new information, new ideas, activating all the different intelligences, the higher intelligence as well as the analytical and the mathematical, and then making it globally affordable. That's where
Jim,
we believe the future of education lies.
Well, Jim, as always, throughout your entire career, founding the Gorbachev Foundation, founding the World Forum for Sustainable Civilization, the Esalen Institute, the Soviet American Exchange, the International Foreign Policy Association, you've done this your entire life, and I appreciate it, because what you're doing is you're showing us a new paradigm, one that so many teachers, people who want to learn, not be a student, but be a learner, and get back to the critical times. What you're telling me, I'm translating it to be almost like a Socrates, return to Socrates' a garden and teaching as Socrates
exactly.
did with the people. That's what you're doing. What a wonderful idea. I'm hearing it with my audience for the first time just right now. All the best on this new venture for you, Jim, because, boy, do we need it. You just opened up a paradigm on this program for us. We're very grateful. And Jim's websites are Ubiquity, U-B-I-Q-U-I-T-Y, ubiquityuniversity.org or wisdomuniversity.org. All the best to you, Jim.
Thank you, and I hope you become a faculty one day.
Well, we will talk about it, because I'm always willing to donate my time for something
Thank
that
you,
looks
Gary.
Like can
Bye-bye.
Be the next opening. Jim Garrison.
Bye.
Wow. And Jim, by the way, is a graduate of both Harvard and Cambridge and one of the finest minds on the planet. You know what's exciting to me? Because what he just outlined there, do you realize how many academics, professors, teachers, do you realize how many people in this world have wanted to do something that transforms the paradigm, but stopped from doing it because they didn't have that inner push or resources or connections? Wow, it's actually a reality. That's so exciting. Back in a moment for part two of our conversation with Remarkable Minds. Now, we won't be able to hear all of it. It is posted on my website, but we can certainly get the most important parts of it with Cornel West, wonderful human being. Wow, is he a wise man. And Chris Hedges, one of the most articulate, intelligent, insightful speakers of the truth on the planet. Stay with us, please. Let's hear from two gentlemen speaking about issues that are so important in ways that the mainstream media, the alternative media, rarely discuss.
With the rise of neoliberalism in the wake of the civil rights movement, welcome, Dr. West.
Blessed to be here again.
So let's take, if I'm correct, let's take the civil rights movement as the starting point. I think you've pointed out that it was a legal victory, but not an economic victory. And that with institutionalized racism, particularly in terms of economic discrimination, the creation of what Malcolm X and I think finally Martin Luther King referred to as our internal colonies, invisible walls, the very physical walls of mass incarceration, you promoted a certain segment Absolutely. Of the black elite into what you refer to as the lumpen bourgeoisie. And yet you could argue that for the bottom three quarters of African Americans in this country, life is maybe worse than when King marched in Selma. There was an assault against the black prophetic tradition, the most important intellectual tradition in America because of its critique of empire, its critique of poverty, its critique of systems of capitalism sustained by white supremacy. What happened to that tradition, which was given voice in the 60s through radical mass movements and our martyrs, Malcolm and Martin, how was it dismantled?
It was dismantled, one, by trying to instill a fear within black people, within poor people, within working people, so that we no longer would want to straighten our backs up and engage in collective fight back. What took the place of collective fight back was individual upward mobility. Mm. So that what was once in place, much more stronger moral conviction, we saw ruthless ambition. So you look at the formation of the black professional class, doctors, lawyers, pharmacists, professors, politicians across the board, they have much less fire. Why? Because they're much more tied to ruthless ambition than they are to moral conviction. They're much less tied to a weak consciousness as opposed to just an I consciousness concerned about upward mobility. There's always going to be some prophetic professionals, but it's a small slice, and it is not connected to the energies of black poor people. It's completely severed.
But to an extent, don't they even demonize the black poor?
Well, I mean, elements of them do, and of course they not only keep a distance, but they can contribute to the callousness and the indifference toward the plight and predicament of the black poor and poor people across the board. So what happens? Well, your warriors end up incarcerated, right, or killed. You get your professionals who surface at the top. They tend to be nerdy, smart, self-promoting, not taking any risks, very little courage, highly conformist, and usually when it comes to battle, complacent. On the other hand, you say, oh, we've got memories of the social movements. And of course, when we talk about the civil rights movement, there is no civil rights victories without the rebellions of Watts.
That's right.
Without Newark, Detroit, we can go on and on. Plainfield had the rebellion right after Newark and so forth. But of course, oftentimes these precious poor people, they were not the beneficiaries of it. Their bodies, their sacrifice, did generate the conditions under which this new black middle class could move into place. But what did it do? For the most part, that black middle class, driven by ruthless ambition, became well-adjusted to injustice and well-adapted to indifference. And so they may point to a Martin Luther King Jr. every January, but Martin Luther King Jr. of 1965 and 1966 and 1968 have no place in how they go about living their lives, engaging in their politics. And of course, black folk, for the most part, became just extensions of a milquetoast neoliberal Democratic Party. But Adolf Reed and a host of others told this story many, many years ago. It's becoming much more crystallized, and we have to be willing to tell the truth no matter how unpopular it is.
So King becomes frozen in that 1963 I Have a Dream speech, and you published a book of King's, it's Radical King.
Anti-imperialist, anti-empire.
And a socialist. And I'm going to read just a little passage from that book that I loved. And it's what your definition of an intellectual, and I said before we began, I would like to know which tenure committee in the American educational system is going to embrace this.
I've never given a damn about tenure other than getting the position to take care of my family. But if I've got to get tenure and can't tell the truth, tenure can kiss my black behind.
Wow,
go right ahead.
The vocation of the intellectual, this is Dr. West, is to let suffering speak, let victims be visible, and let social misery be put on the agenda of those in power. And second, that moral action is based on a broad, robust propheticism that highlights systemic social analysis of the circumstances under which tragic persons struggle. So talk about that, because we have seen such a corruption, not just of the black intellectual class, but the white intellectual class. They have sold themselves to a neoliberal agenda, which is promoted widely within academia. Many of these elite colleges and universities are virtually corporations themselves. Talk about that concept of the organic intellectual and what's taking place.
Well, one is you have to keep track of what the prophetic intellectuals are up against. Massive commodification, big money, big banks, big corporations trying to incorporate black voices, white voices, brown voices, intellectuals, academics, to in many ways keep them distant from a prophetic tradition that will bring critique to bear, not just in a narrow talk about discrimination, not just in a narrow talk about liberal reform, but of a highly financialized monopoly capitalist system, which is global, in which, as we see in Greece, the big banks dictate and the poor people suffer.
Right.
Same is true in Latin America, same is true in the United States with Wall Street. The probably the biggest challenge when it comes to the black freedom struggle is in 2008, when you actually have a black president who can say in March of 2009 with the biggest CEOs of the biggest banks, I stand between you and the pitchforks. I'm on your side. I will protect you. But when he speaks to black people, it's paternalistic,
right,
or a symbolic gesture. Now, finally, he's made it to the prisons, highly deodorized prisons. You don't see prisoners. Selected prison, nonviolent persons,
right,
as opposed to a larger population. You and I, of course, have been blessed to teach it,
right,
at Rahway with our precious brothers there in philosophy and history and so forth. Very different dynamic. What happens then? Well, the black political class and the black professional class follows this Pied Piper, neoliberal, pro-drone, pro-massive surveillance, pro-Israeli occupation, pro-ecological devastation with drilling. Thank God for Brother Bob McKibben and the others. And we have to say what? Well, even if we're at the moment lone voices or relatively lone voices, this great tradition will not be suffocated in the name of some empty victory of a black professional or political class that cannot speak to the suffering that these structures produce.
Has the election of a black president in Barack Obama been, maybe since the assaults of the 1960s, the most devastating thing for the black prophetic tradition?
No, I think it's the big banks, it's Wall Street, it's Pentagon, it's State Department, it's military budget that's been much more devastating. It's the privatizing of education that's been more devastating. But at the political level, it's contributed to that devastation.
But I meant in the sense that it has essentially, with all of those forces that you just named,
yes,
it has seduced,
yes,
a segment
it's
of
hidden.
The blacks to essentially back what under the black prophetic
That's
tradition
right.
they had understood as the evils within the
American
absolutely,
system. Absolutely. That's why I wouldn't say that it's the major force. It's the force that is hidden and conceal the devastation of Wall Street, Pentagon, State Department, so forth and so on, with the window dressing.
Right.
With the window dressing, you see. And Brother Barack Obama, he's a master at smoke and mirrors. He's a master
at
window
dressing. Well, that's why he is where he is.
That's it, absolutely. So when I spend the time with the young folk in St. Louis and Ferguson and Oakland, we just had a wonderful gathering of Brother Pastor Michael McBride's church, The Way there on University Avenue in Berkeley. Unbelievably prophetic. The awakening is taking place. Why? Police murder is something one cannot avoid. You have to come to terms with it. Sandra Bland, we can go on and on and on. And it's wonderfully led more and more by not just black sisters, but black queer sisters. So you can hit the issues of homophobia,
right,
why you hit the issues of male supremacy, why you hit the issues of white supremacy. But in the end, if you're not hitting monopoly capitalism, if you're not hitting the imperial policies that flow therefrom, you're still not going to be at the root of what we need to come to terms with.
Isn't the election of Obama really a kind of window into internal colonialism, in a sense that colonial powers would find an indigenous, largely aristocratic elite who would profit personally from the oppression? Isn't it a species of internal colonialism?
A certain song, but even among the black masses, there's such deep desperation.
Mm.
There's a hunger for even symbolic victory, because the class war against working and poor people has been so intense, and we were relatively defeated in the sense of the massive transfer of wealth from poor and working people to the well-to-do, the 1%. who have been getting off scot-free. What is it now? Almost 40% of the wealth.
Right.
1% of the population under Obama got 95% of the wealth under his administration. You see, that kind of unbelievable wealth inequality, you have to come to terms with that if we don't just go off a cliff. I mean, it may be the case that the white supremacy, the male supremacy, and the xenophobia and the capitalist ethos cut so deep, America would rather just blow up the world and go off a cliff than talk about justice. But, I mean, that's why we are a blues people. You see, we know it's catastrophic. Mm. That ain't no news at all. The question is, what you going to do with the catastrophe? Are you going to go down fighting and swinging? Or are you going to be scared and intimidated and afraid? Are you going to tell the truth or say what needs to be said for your career?
Well, they've done a pretty good job of shutting down truth tellers in this society, and they've mounted a pretty vicious campaign against you on black radio.
No, but the reality is that I'm stronger than ever. I'm stronger now than I was 6 years ago. Not just intellectually, but spiritually and politically. You see, the only way they're going to completely snuff me out is to put a bullet in my heart, and death, where is thy sting? Grave, where is thy victory? So in that sense, it's not just me.
You were listening to A Conversation with Remarkable Minds, Chris Hedges and Professor Cornel West, two people I have a great deal of respect for. The complete conversation can be heard on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com. One final little announcement. We are sitting in our office where I was told today from Luda that WBAI has a bunch of gifts that we have given, but no one's come to pick them up. If anyone in the audience has a car or a van and can drop by, because these are going to be premiums. What is the total here? $17,312 gifts that we are giving WBAI and its audience because they didn't have the money to pay for them. So at this time, I'm willing to do that, but someone's got to come and pick them up. We keep calling, no one comes. So will someone in the audience come and help? If you get it over there, I'm sure that the volunteers will send them out to you. Call my office for instructions how to get there. We would appreciate it. And I'm sure people would love to get premiums. And now that they have them, call 646-926-5422. Have a nice day, everyone.